You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Don't forget to follow us on our Facebook page, Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast, on Twitter at RealGilbertACP, and on Instagram, Gilbert Podfried, PODFRIED. You see, it's kind of a pun on the last name. Never mind. This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre, and we're here at the Friars Club in New York City. Our guests today are a screenwriter, television writer, and playwright who's written 12 TV pilots as well as the screenplays for the movies The Guru and Confessions of a Shopaholic. And our other guest, a songwriter, singer, actor, and member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame, who's written some of the most popular and enduring songs of our lifetimes, including We've Only Just Begun, Rainy Days and Mondays, and The Rainbow Connection, among many others. He's also an actor. He's appeared in everything from Smokey and the Bandit to Phantom of the Paradise to Batman the Animated Series. So please welcome Tracy Jackson and Paul Williams.
Thank you.
thank you.
Yay! Thank you. Yeah. Welcome, so much guys. Fun to welcome. Be here.
Now I want to hear you sing those songs.
Okay.
Sharing horizons. Gilbert sings the Paul Williams songbook.
I think that would be a hit album.
It
would be
sings on almost every episode.
Yes.
Now. And as a matter of fact, he sang a little bit of a Paul Williams song on one episode. Paul.
And he sang?
Gilbert, you want to tell
nice
Paul?
Nice to be around.
Oh, my God. You know that one?
Yes.
Okay.
Paul's going to want money because of ASCAP. You better probably send it over. Keep that stuff really quiet.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, then I'll keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, no, he's going to put his hand up.
Sing away, child.
Go ahead, give him a little bit of it.
Okay, I always sing Paul Williams songs as Paul Williams. So, yes. Hello, with affection from a sentimental fool. To a little girl who's broken every rule. One that brings me up when all the others seem to let me down. One who's nice to be around. Should I say that it's a blue world without you? Whisper words I remember from old love songs, but all wrong, 'cause I never called it love before. This feeling's new, it came with you, and I know
that the nicest things have never seemed to last. That we're both a bit embarrassed by our past.
But I think there's something special in the feeling that we found. And you're nice to be around.
I think you guys have to go on the road.
Wonderful.
I think you guys have to go on the
What's
road.
Amazing is you sound exactly like John Biner doing me.
John Biner does you? That's great.
Maybe that's how you sound, Paulie.
Oh, it's the way I used to sound because of my, you know, because I couldn't breathe. My nose was so full of cocaine. I couldn't, you know, should I say that it's a blue? Then I got sober and all of a sudden I was, should I say that it's a, wow, where'd this voice come from? It's because you didn't have your nose in a mirror all those years. You wouldn't have sounded like that, you know.
You see, I think I liked your singing better on cocaine.
but you wouldn't have liked the rest of me any better. Yeah, wouldn't have liked the rest of me. She knew me then.
And I feel so bad that I didn't include the first part of the song. It was, hello, what a silly way to
Such
start.
Such a simple way to say,
oh, what? What a simple way to start a love affair.
Should I jump right in and say how much I care? Or should I jump right in and say how much I care? You know, and without the voice, like I should be saying things like, Gilbert, are you my daddy? Gilbert, are you my daddy?
Would you take me for a madman?
Or a simple-hearted...
Tracy, jump in here and save me.
Oh, Tracy.
Now, I can't sing. So
what
no,
did
I'm
you
here.
Write that and a couple of other songs with John Williams?
I wrote that with John Williams. That was for a movie called Cinderella
yes.
Liberty.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. James Caan.
Yeah, it was
Eli Wallach.
I mean, if you're going to write songs for a movie, there's what an amazing way to begin is to have somebody like John Williams pull you into the process. You know, so it was John Williams and the director, Mark...
Rydell?
Mark Rydell, gave me the job. It was fabulous.
For anyone out there who wouldn't know John Williams, which is shocking...
yeah, turn off the show immediately.
He wrote... Bum, 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 bum. He wrote Jaws...
Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark,
Schindler's List,
every
Spielberg film, exactly. And including a million others.
I wonder if he's divorced and has to give away a lot of his royalties.
And the two
you know,
of you
it's going around. I hear it's going around. I hear
yes,
yeah. But yeah, it was a great way to start my career. And it was like the first stuff I ever wrote for a feature film. We wrote five songs for that. But yeah, brilliant man,
and. Okay, if we could start with... Now, your father was... How tall was your father?
6'2". But do we want to talk about my journey like that? Or do we want
to
talk about gratitude and trust?
Because how tall your father was. You know,
we'll get to both of them.
I had two brothers. They're both 6-footers. And it made... You know, I have a mild resentment. Mm-hmm. But here's the story. The interesting thing is they gave me shots to make me grow when I was like 9 because I was kind of falling behind. If they hadn't done that, I probably would have wound up at the same height as my brothers and all. But they gave me shots. A doctor said, let's try something. Let's give him male hormone, which did not make me any taller, but it gave me a huge hard-on. And what was interesting, all of it, you know, so it's the headwaters of why I write codependent love songs is because at 9 years old, I was humping my Aunt Laverne's leg. I mean, it was just, you know... They went, okay, stop the hormone shots. Immediately stop the hormone shots, you know. So you know, yeah, I was more interested in, you know, in my toy chest, no, but Aunt Laverne's chest, yeah, you know. So, but anyway, I kind of screwed things up. So it's my body clock got all messed up. I didn't hit puberty until I was out of high school. And I took a spurt. I was 4'6" when I graduated. And then I spurted up to 5'2", you know. And it slowed everything down. But now, when I'm about to turn 75, I'm thrilled to have things, you know. I mean, I have three kids that are in their 30s, and their dad is feeling about the same age as them, you know, and is about as mature.
You look great for 75, Paul.
Thank you,
if I could blow a little smoke
thank
up
you,
your skirt.
Thank you.
Now, tell us how you met Tracy. There's a story. What,
blowing smoke up my skirt?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you sure?
You tell the story.
Can we turn the cameras on?
Yeah. Paul's not going to blow, and I'm wearing pants, so we'll try and do that.
And your origin, the story of how you met involves an iconic actor.
It does. Paul's hero. Well, I was a Paul Williams fan when I was a kid. I'm beginning to think that all kids who have come from fucked up families watched Mike Douglas every day. I think that he was like the babysitter for all disenfranchised children. But I was crazy about Paul. I loved his music. I was, and he moved to Santa Barbara, where I grew up. And I was friendly with Robert Mitchum. And there were like three celebrities in Santa Barbara. There was Robert Mitchum. There was Steve Martin, who lived on the hill and never came down. And there was Jonathan Winters. Uh-huh. And when Jonathan Winters moved to Santa Barbara, he was really bored. So he would go up every day to the Upper Village, and he would do his act.
Just for strangers in the street?
No, just like for anyone. Like, he'd stand in front of the market or the store. Great. And he would do his act. And when he first got there, everybody was like really happy because like Santa Barbara was a boring city, right? So all of a sudden there's Jonathan Winters, and you go to the market, and he's like, you know, he's doing his whole thing, and you're kind of cool, and you get this big crowd. Well, this went on for years, and it got to the point where you go, shit, I've got 40 minutes, and you'd park around the back because there'd be Jonathan, you know, doing season three of the So when Paul came to town, I was very excited. I didn't get to meet him right away. And then Mitchum had a New Year's Day party. And Dorothy Mitchum, known as the sheriff, to try and keep Bob out of trouble, which was not successful, said that Paul Williams was going to be there. So I got all dressed up. And sure enough, there he was in like a little Andy Gibb jacket that didn't sort of. And I went up to him and I said, Mr. Williams, I love you so much. I've loved your music my whole life. You're just like everything. I was just total sycophant. I'm 22 years old. I mean, come on. And he looks at me and goes, well, as long as it got you laid. Oh, and he turns on his heels and he walks away.
Classic first impression.
So then I decided that I like Neil Diamond better. And,
understandable.
And then we got a photo op on Bob's bed, which is Paul's favorite thing about our relationship, is we got a photo op on Bob's bed.
I love saying that we met in Robert Mitchum's bed.
That's a good story.
He loves that. Yeah. Well, you love people to think you spent a lot of time in Robert Mitchum's bedroom.
Exactly. But I wasn't, you know, it's like we didn't have our noses in each other's laps. We had our noses on little mirrors.
You and Bob or you and me?
Me and Bob. No. Neither one of us. Okay. You know, yeah. But Mitchum spoke to a lot of dope. And Mitchum was like a doughboy. He called me doughboy. His nickname was the goose because he walked like a goose. You know, he had that shoulder thing. And he called me the doughboy for the Pillsbury Doughboy. And he'd be like, hey, doughboy. Doughboy, try this shit. It's no good, but you might like it. And then he'd give you something scraped off to King Tut that was just going to put you back in grade school mentality and leave you there for a week, you know. And that's probably where I was when Tracy walked in there, because I was not that nasty a guy. But that, I mean, what came out of my mouth was just, that day I was just arrogant, little sexist, little prick, you know. So she wandered out, she said, spun on her heels, a Neil Diamond fan, left the room and all. But then we met in 2001, I think, when I was at Feinstein's, and she and her husband Glenn came to see my show, and I was different. I was at that time 11 years sober, and when we hit it off, and we became best friends.
You thought I got a second shot at this? Not screwing this friendship.
Exactly. Before that, I had a deal at Sony, and I wanted to do a TV. I'd always liked him, no matter what, even after he said that. And I was writing TV shows at Sony, and I went in one day and they said, "Who do you want to? You know, what do you want to do?" It was like the good old days, right? And I said, "I'd like to do a show for Paul Williams." And like all the suits looked at me and went, "Well, if you back the cocaine truck up into the stage door, maybe." And that was it. They nixed it. And he couldn't get a job. I mean, that was the time you couldn't get a job.
But I also didn't know, because it was in the 80s, as I imagine. And in
it was
the
90s.
It was in the 90s. Oh, in the 90s, 91. I wasn't even trying. I was learning to be me. I was nearly sober.
You were telling me before about how you used to send people in to your meetings.
My manager, Denny Bond, would go to me. I'd send him to creative meetings for me because I couldn't leave the house. You know, I would say that I had a dental emergency, and so he would go and have a creative meeting on my behalf. How rude is that? I mean, how, you know, somebody is nice enough to offer you a job, and you send your manager because you're too stoned to go? That was me in the 80s, you know?
And you said you kind of felt like you were sending people out like you are Frank Sinatra.
Who I thought I was. And, you know, and then I got sober and I went, you know who I used to think I was? Not even, do you know who I used to be? It's like, do you know who I used to think I was? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I carried a gun until I got sober. And, you know, I had a permit and everything. And I got sober. I looked down. I saw, oh, my God, that's embarrassing. What is this thing on my hip? This growth with S&W on the side. Oh, it's Smith & Wesson. Get rid of that. Yeah, that's... that's not who I am. That's who I was in, with the arrogance that, and the, you know, and the paranoia that cocaine brings.
Yeah, to be drunk and stoned and carry a gun
and armed.
Yeah,
exactly.
Might not be the smartest.
You know, writing children's movies. You know?
And now Tracy mentioned the Mike Douglas show. Which,
oh yeah.
Now it was filmed in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And you said that actor Peter Lawford called you.
Oh, this is in the documentary.
Yeah, it's in the documentary. Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, Peter Lawford said, look, he said, I just did the show, the Mike Douglas show. And he says, so they're not going to want me back and all, but every host, your guest host, every guest host can ask each day for one guest. Ask for me. Ask for me because there is some blow in Philadelphia. And my family knows if I go back to Philadelphia, just to go back to Philadelphia, they'll know exactly why I'm going there. But if you ask me, so if you look at the episode of and it's in the documentary, if you look at the episode of the little clip from Mike Douglas with Peter Lawford and I, we're so ripped. And so it's like, first of all, we look like a couple parrots. We can't stop moving. You know, it's just like, and I'm just laughing at everything. Wait a minute.
You sounded like
drug
Gilbert.
Test Gilbert. Quickly.
There's actually a clip in the documentary of the two of you.
We're clearly just ripped, you know.
And we're talking about the documentary, so we should plug it. Paul Williams Still Alive.
Paul Williams Still Alive.
Which
I'm
both
living proof I'm with Gilbert today.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that doesn't prove anything. Yeah.
We all loved it. Dara, too.
And you said also from your father you got you really adopted your drinking problem.
Well, I think there's a genetic propensity to be a lush in the Williams family. I had two brothers that were, you know, that were drunks. My dad was a drunk. I was drunk. My younger brother is, I think, 13 years sober. My older brother was sober when he passed away from a heart attack and all. He never couldn't quit smoking. But, yeah, Williams have the gene, you know. When I was 5 years old, 4, 5, 6 years old at a family picnic, they'd give us a little glass of beer and all. And I would want to sing.
Like Frank Sinatra.
Exactly. You know, and for a while when I was 9, I could, you know.
And your father used to pick you up in the car when you were a little kid, and he'd be like sloshed at the wheel.
I remember spinning out in the middle of a field, you know, somebody coming over and just yelling at him in the window, saying, you're going to kill those kids or yourself someday, Paul. You're going to kill those. And I wound up doing the exact same thing with my kids. When I left my wife and kids, I had a home up in Montecito. I had a home in L.A. I'd drive up and get my kids, and I was driving back and forth just as loaded as my dad was. It, you know, did the same thing. What I got, though, was when I finally got a place in my life where I hit my knees, said I need some help, and there were people there to help me, and they gave me my life back. You know.
And your father would tell us what happened to him eventually.
He was killed in a one-car accident. He drove into the abutment of a bridge when I was 13. He was drunk, and he lived a week, you know. So, you know, he was a sweet, sweet man. I would love it if he had gotten sober, if he had found the avenue of recovery that I took, which incidentally I don't talk about on the air in specifics. I don't mention that organization. But that organization that saved my life he would have loved the hearts in there. He would have loved the kindness, the spiritual awakening that was awaiting for anybody that's life is on the brink right now. End of commercial.
Well, it's all,
now.
It's
and
also now, back to gratitude and trust.
It's interesting that you and Tracy would get together and write a book about recovery because, unlike you, she was not a drug user.
Never.
She was not. She was a good girl, if I may say.
In some ways.
Yes. Not
tell us the bad
way. Not with an addictive.
I was a slut. But what I used to say, I was a slut from a very early age.
And why didn't I meet you back then?
Yeah, that's what Paul always says. But what I didn't do, I used to say this. I used to say, I'm fucking everybody, but I'm not taking drugs. That was my thing. And you know what? I mean, like, you pick your poison. I was terrified of drugs. I believed Reefer Madness. Like, when they show it in school.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. I was the kid that went, I get it. It's a gateway drug.
If you save one person,
and that's what I say. If you save one person, I was that person. I never did. I was offered drugs by Hunter Thompson. I've been offered drugs by everybody. I had an agent who kept trying to have sex with me when I was in Hollywood, and he would bring me Quaaludes remember the old Quaalude days? And I would just take them and I'd put them in a little bottle in my medicine chest. And I had like 50 of them. And one day someone came in my apartment and they went in my medicine chest and they go, whoa, you got 50 ludes in here. And I went, oh yeah, I guess so. Can I have them? But you know, everyone used to check everyone's. Never touched a thing. I mean, nothing. And so it's a really, it was a really interesting thing that we, I'm the, you know, we're the yin and the yang of, and I can have a glass of wine, and I do at night. I'll have a glass of wine, or I'll leave half of it. I mean, you've seen me leave.
Yeah, which makes me crazy.
More halves of glasses of wine.
Doesn't it bug you also that Hunter Thompson?
It kills him.
Yeah.
That she didn't take it. You know, it's like, you know, the stories.
Oh, but it would have driven. Yeah. It would have. Oh, but Gilbert, you would have loved. Did you ever know Hunter Thompson?
No.
You would have. This is a story I have to tell you because you would have loved this. My husband sells rare books and manuscripts, and we went out to see Hunter Thompson right before he died, actually. And I wanted to see the Oscars. It was Oscar night. And all I said was, I don't care as long as I get to see the Oscars. So we go out to this house in the middle of, like, God fuck nowhere in the snow. And it hasn't had the windows
open.
What's
the name of the town again?
Woody Creek. The windows
have
not...
No, I like the other title.
Like your
God fuck nowhere.
And it's like...
I think I played a comedy club.
I'm sure you did.
The windows had not been open since 1961. And he'd been smoking hash in there all day, every day. You walk in and I just want to watch the Oscars, okay? And he's got this setup where he's got a TV, and he has all of his drugs, which he kept offering me, which I wouldn't take. And he has his phone. And every time the phone rings, like if you called him, it would play. You say, I can't do your voice, but it would play, you know, Gilbert, you know, Hunter, it's Gilbert. I want to talk to you. Let's have lunch. And he had a TV where if you change the channel, it went to whatever you were watching, to porn, and then back to a movie that was starring him. So for the entire Oscars, I swear to God. So it'd be like, and now best screenwriters are, and then you'd go to like, he'd switch the channel, be like two girls fucking in a hot tub, right? And then he would switch it back and be like, he and Benicio del Toro doing blow. And then it would switch it back to like, and then, you know, Billy Crystal singing a song. And then it would go to like five guys doing each other. And this went on all night long with all this hash. I swear to God, I went running out of there in the snow at like 3 a.m. wanting to kill myself.
I'm so horny right now.
But
I need to be alone for a little while. Give me a second. It won't take long.
Set your TV so every other channel is porn. It can be done.
Now, here's something I always wondered. I mean, it's nothing, just me. The idea of, suffering and being drunk and stoned and creativity.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I'm kind of, I always I think a lot of people avoid psychiatry because they don't want to ruin what's making them so creative.
I think it's an interesting question. I get that, you know, at the headwaters of most of our creativity, our creative lives, whatever, you find a lot of broken people. I mean, I don't think that you, what's your line about it? If you got a date for the...
Well, that's in Hollywood. Show me a comedy writer who went to the prom, and I'll show you a network executive.
That covers it right.
In a few words,
why I love her, but also in one sentence covers exactly what you're talking about.
It's not
about
my line, by the way. It's Chuck Lorre's. Yeah. I cannot take credit.
It's kind of like I think with an oyster, if it's got some kind of an irritation, it's how it makes it.
Oh, I love
purr.
That.
Yeah, and if it didn't have that irritation, something bothering it wouldn't be a
I've never compared
pearl.
You to Pearl Buck before, but I will from now on. It's like an amazing, you know, it's
it
just...
It kind of looks like her.
Yeah, exactly.
He's mistaken for Pearl
laughing.
Buck.
Yeah. But you know what? The fact is that you know, a lot of people say, you know, I mean, there were guys that said, you know what, you're not as funny straight as you were, you know, you're not as good, whatever. I was working on a musical based on this called The Secret Life of Queen Victoria. And I was working with a couple of really funny guys and great guys and all. And I think they were saying to me, I remember one of them saying to me at the time, you're not as good loaded as you, sober as you were loaded, which is, you know, the fact is now that I look back on it, I think I was lying to him about being sober then, you know, so that's a relief. But I wrote in spite of the drugs. I mean, I would get a little bit of sleep. I'd wake up and do the work that was good. And there would be 7 pages of just crap from before when I was loaded and all. And also, it's interesting that I had the kind of career that I did in the 70s when I hadn't crossed the line from abuse to use to abuse to addiction. But you go jump into the 80s and I did Ishtar. I mean, it's like, you know, the 70s was, you know,
I like
nominated
Ishtar.
For 6 Academy Awards. I won one. In the 80s, I did Ishtar, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, that's, you could tell that to kids, and that's pretty much the story of my life, you know.
But I also think that you were, and that question always does come up, especially in a lot of the work that we're doing now. And I think you can get away in the beginning with a certain amount of abuse and creativity. But I mean, what's the longevity of a career? It's discipline. And I think just like, you know, you did it until you just burned yourself out, and then you had to go away and get clean and come back. Yeah. And you can't sustain. Look at all the people who were real drug addicts. They're dead. you know, or they're no longer working. It's you just can't. That, you got. Except for Keith Richards. You got to have that discipline at the end of the day, right?
Had,
you got to show
had
up.
Had they not been doing drugs, would there have been a Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band?
Ooh, good question. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think, as a matter of fact, I think that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band probably exists because there was enough sobriety in the room to get it done.
Oh, okay.
Because they weren't all doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that you know, if you take George Martin out of the mix,
I was just going to say,
there is no Sgt. Pepper.
Thank God he was there.
Yeah.
You know, or you look at Lenny Bruce. You look at anyone who just completely self-destructed. Would Lenny Bruce have stayed gone if Lenny Bruce hadn't been a drug addict? How long would his career have been?
What always got me about, like, when they talk about comics like Belushi or Chris Farley, and they'll go, oh, there was the good side of him where he'd run naked down the street screaming at people, but then there was the bad side, the drugs. And you go,
wait a minute. Yeah. Hold on a second. Let me get out my dictionary here and check out what is good
and
what
perspective.
Is bad.
That's perspective.
I heard George Carlin say he used to light up a joint just to do the polish when he was writing comedy.
Yeah.
And I always wondered if, you know, a little bit of stimulation was not a bad thing as
Faulkner,
part of the creative
Faulkner
process.
Faulkner wrote drunk and edited sober, or was it the other way
That's
around?
That's Hemingway.
No, was that Hemingway?
Yeah.
Wow. What? I was so impressed that I'd used a line about Faulkner, and then I fucked it up. Wow.
We'll have you reach out. We'll have you dub it later.
What condition was he in when he shot himself?
I think fucked up.
Oh, okay.
What condition was he what?
When he shot himself.
Or certainly depressed.
Oh, yeah, certainly depressed. Which seems to be...
I think your brain, when you're young, can absorb a certain amount of stuff. And then you hit your middle age, and it goes, time out, you know?
Exactly.
Either you get clean or you're going to die.
Exactly.
I do think that's true. I just think you can't do it.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
And now we should concentrate a little bit on your career in this interview.
Or a lack of drugs.
I mean, Paul, you became, and I remember it was like, you became... During the 70s and 80s, I guess, it was like where you popped up on every single show.
Oh, I became, you know, like I was addicted to this. I was addicted to, America's Sweetheart. It's what, I mean, being different is tough. You know, being special is, in my case, addicting. You know, when I was treated like I was somebody, I went any place where I would get that treatment. You know, I mean, it just... Plopped down a camera and a couch, and I was on that couch. You know, I did Carson 48 times. The joke is that I remember six, but the fact is that I became better at showing off than showing up, and my craft suffered. And it just I loved the attention. I loved the attention. I would have stayed there until I actually burned out every possible venue of being seen. But another addiction outran it, and the addiction that outran it was my addiction to cocaine and alcohol. And that one of the elements of that disease is isolation. And so when the desire to be loved, you know, when what I would call a claptrap, you know, there's a clap. I was in a claptrap. I loved, and it's not that kind of clap. It's this kind of clap. I did a little of both, but the fact is that
TMI
was
Polly. I
fell victim to the clap trap. I loved the attention. I loved the applause.
Well, there's a great thing in the documentary, a great moment where after you win the Oscar, the next morning, Circus of the Stars calls.
Yeah, and as I said, we searched the Parachute Club of America's record books, and all we're looking for a celebrity that skydives, and you're the only one we could find. It's not you, is it? And I went, yeah, it is. And I was like, because I had that moment. I just saw, okay, I just won the Oscar. Now what? You know, it's like I needed to feel. I needed to be a little more special, a little more different, a little more courageous, a little more whatever.
Was it thrills, chasing thrills, or just chasing the need to be noticed more?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of guys who I thought were absolute assholes, and I didn't know what they were talking about. Said to me, "You're probably just trying to like prove that you're a man, even though you're short." And I said, "That's bullshit." And then I spent thousands of dollars on Kleinian analysis, and my therapist said, "You're trying to prove you're a man just because it's like the exact same thing truck drivers have been telling me for years." You know?
And wow. One of your like bandmates or something, a musician, said to you at one point,
Chris Caswell said, "I'm worried about you." I fired him. I fired him on the spot. Incidentally, he's working for me still, working with me still. I got an email last night with our music cues for the podcast, Ms. Jackson.
Excellent.
But so. it is funny with fame. It is one of those drugs that when you first get it, it's a real high, and then it's not even as big a high afterwards, but you have to keep it. going. Like, you know, if they tell you to do porn and you go, well, people are going to see it and I'll still be famous.
I took my clothes off in a movie and they changed the rating from R to PG. It's just insane. It's so insulting. You know? It's just insulting, you know. But, yeah, I just, you know, it's addicting. You know, it's totally addicting.
Tracy, do you have some of the same issues in as far as being attracted to show business? That it, was it all about the work, or was there some desire to, hey, let me get a little taste of this glamour, a little bit of fame?
I always wanted to be an actress from the time I was very young.
You wanted to be Marlo Thomas, right?
I wanted to be Marlo Thomas.
Yeah.
I wanted to be Marlo Thomas, and I wanted to marry Donald Hollinger. You know, I always wanted to be an actress, and then by the time I was 27, I wasn't getting the parts that I should have gotten. Mm-hmm. I think there's a moment when you want to do that, and I started to write on a bet, and then within 6 months, I had a huge agent, and I was writing pilots, and I was had an overall deal, and Yeah, part of me wanted it, and part of me still likes it, if people know who I am. But for me, then it just became about the work. I'm pretty happy just being able to work every day and expressing myself. And if people know who I am, then I'm happy, sure. But I never experienced that enormous kind of fame that it became who I was. I mean, there was one point when I made a documentary, and for about 3 weeks, I became really, really well known. And, like, the Inquirer was following my daughter and I around. And in that moment, I went, you know, this is not so great. I don't think that this is something that I really want in my life. So, but I never experienced the Pauly experience. But I did always want I've always wanted to be known for what I do. And I think as long as you get to work, it's not even. I don't know. Maybe I'm a little healthier than Paul. But
I was going
to
say, my line was going to be once again, mental health rears its ugly head.
I think fame or money and recognition for your work. They give you the opportunity to do more work. I mean, when she says True Gilbert, I mean, you kill it in a club, and then you get a better club, and then you get a better... And as long as you keep doing the work, and you don't let that go to your head in a way that corrupts you, you just get to do better work. I think for me, it was just always about the chance to keep working and get to do better work. And if that meant you get to be a little bit better known... That's how you do it.
Mental health.
Well, no, I'm kind of screwy, too.
We should introduce you to our friend Bill Persky, who created that girl.
I've met Bill Persky, actually. Yes, I have met Bill Persky.
Since you're so Donald Hollinger and Anne-Marie obsessed.
Oh, I would totally.
And you wrote an episode of Beretta.
Yeah, Paul, Robert what the hell? Blake. And a Hawaii 5-0.
I was on the couch with Robert Blake. I said, I love your show. I'd love to do it sometime. He said, write one. I was the only leader. I was the only one that did, you know. But you've acted a bunch through the years and all, and you found a whole thing in voiceover. Is that not the most wonderful?
Oh, yes.
You know?
Yes.
Where did that start? Just.
Oh, okay.
Paul is now interviewing Gilbert.
Yes.
Paul is now interviewing Gilbert.
He's a better interviewer than I am.
Well, you guys are about to launch your own podcast, though.
It's funny because that's where you slid into, like, you started acting, but then you slid into, do you not love doing that as well?
Yes, I love doing voiceover work. I mean, I guess what really was the main thing.
Okay, let me admit something.
Yeah.
I'm really not interested in your voiceover, but I have to admit something. I noticed that, like, three times Tracy, like, addressed you and took things right back to you, and I thought, I'm such an asshole. I'm just sitting here talking about myself. I think I should probably ask Gilbert something right now.
Yeah, but I'm not as self-obsessed as you are, and that's my whole thing about
that's
having
exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, so that's what I observed.
And
so it was like a mild moment of progress for me where I said, you know, because I don't really care about
you don't
Gilbert.
Even care about Gilbert that much at this
well,
point.
Well, no, I do care about Gilbert, but I don't think there's anything interesting about how he became a voiceover actor. But I was horribly guilt-ridden.
This refreshing honesty, Paul.
And all I could think about was how many green envelopes does he get from Aladdin? You see, that's the writer in me, right?
We're having a moment here.
Rigorous honesty. And you know what? That's what I'm most excited about. About us doing a podcast because you can just do that. I mean, it's
what?
Like
you can just take over and not talk to the guest.
No, but you can be honest. You can be just totally honest, and it's conversation, and it's real. That's what's a treat about sitting here. Beyond the fact that we get to talk about my favorite subject, me.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm most looking forward to is just
talking
is
about
just,
you. Well, I'm not going to let you. So
I know that. No, but just conversation. You know,
an honest conversation. Apparently.
Honest conversation.
Well, Brittany,
you know,
since you brought it up.
That's recovery.
So tell us about the show since you brought it up. And
we don't.
You haven't launched it yet?
No, tomorrow. We go tonight. Podcast one.
Give us a date since this. We don't know when this will run. It won't be tomorrow.
Tuesday, June 9th will be our first podcast on Podcast One.
Weekly.
We're Gratitude and Trust weekly. We're starting out weekly. Great. You guys are weekly, right? Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
You're weekly.
Very weekly.
Very weekly.
No, you're not.
Hey, Tracy's a fan of the podcast, Gil. She listens.
Really?
I've been binging it. Yeah.
And Paul hates it?
Nope.
No.
No, but Paul, he hasn't been on it yet. Once he's on it, he'll listen.
Paul can't find his car keys. You want me to find a link to the podcast? And, you know it's like...
I'll go. I have a great memory.
I'd like you to meet her. Hi, Tracy.
I'll say, let's listen to Gilbert. He'll go, let's listen to The Nerdist. We're on there. I go, well, soon we'll be on Gilbert. Then we go.
Yeah, exactly. I love it.
Okay, and it's called Gratitude.
Gratitude and Trust.
Gratitude and Trust.
Based on the book. You know,
based on the book.
The concept of the book was that recovery is not just for addicts. You know, and it's interesting, as we went around and started talking about the book and everything, there's a kind of a connection that the two of us have that people would say, the two of you ought to be doing a show. You ought to be doing a show. And all of a sudden, the idea for a podcast came up.
Well, that's actually, I realized how many books it took to get on the New York Times bestseller list. The week we got on the bestseller list. And then I realized
how many...
We sold
98 books that week.
I realized how many, even a not a successful podcast, how many hits you get.
Yeah.
I went, let's do the podcast.
Yeah.
It's the new thing.
The new thing, yeah.
So we're called Norm Pattison.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'm learning from you guys.
What's in his brain, Gilbert?
This is what I want. What's in his brain?
That's what I'd like to find out.
You don't want to know, Tracy.
Yeah,
you don't want to
know. I mean, the memory is... I listen to these podcasts, and he'll be like, you know, Marie Osmond showed up on the lot wearing a pink dress, and she parked in the third...
It's too much.
Like, it's like insane.
It's too much.
How long were you on The View? How long did you work on The View?
2 years.
Yeah.
A little over two.
That's where we met.
Yeah. I loved your performance. And you introduced me to your co-writer... For the gentleman who co-wrote Rainbow Connection was with you.
Oh, Kenny Ashton.
Kenny was in the dressing room.
Exactly. Yeah. Kenny and I wrote a bunch of songs together.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side?
Again, John Vander. Rainbows are visions,
but only
illusions.
Rainbows have nothing to...
Okay, I'll do Willie Nelson, you do me.
Okay. Oh, great.
So we've been told, and so it's too high. Why are there so many songs about rainbows?
What's on the other side?
Rainbows are visions, only illusions. Rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know the wrong way to say.
We one day will find it.
The Rainbow Connection!
The lovers, the dreamers, and me!
You get what you do, Paul. I will never speak again.
You just ruined your voice, Paul. Wow.
Okay, interview me. You be Gilbert, and I'll be Paul.
All right, I'll be Gilbert. All right.
So,
what'd you have for breakfast?
Well, I had some scrambled eggs and some orange juice.
Is it true you're as well endowed as they say you are?
No. My penis is quite tiny.
That's not what I heard.
Oh, Lord.
I always wanted to ask myself that question.
It's barely...
I heard they called you the log. The legend of the log. That's been nicknamed the Enterprise.
No. It's barely visible to the human eye.
Oh, I thought you were talking about my talent. I thought we were talking about your talent. Oh. That's your cock.
Now you've done it. You got Paul Williams working blue, Gil.
Yes,
now can we?
Oh, I wish you would do this more often.
May I talk about my balls now?
What did you call them earlier? I have burglar balls.
Oh, yeah, I said, balls of a burglar.
Balls of a burglar.
Yeah, for going through that jungle in the Philippines.
I will steal for sure.
Oh. Speaking of your songwriting, The segues are not easy to make.
You mean from cop to songwriting? That was like a hard...
Well, I just want to ask a question about the Rainbow Connection. You said one line in the song may be the best line you've ever written.
Who said that every wish would be heard and answered if wished on a morning star? The line is, somebody thought of that and someone believed it. Look what it's done so far.
It's great.
And God, I can't hear after doing Gilbert's voice. Yes,
that happens. Like, how do you think I feel every week?
My inner ear that is now, you know, suddenly wants to stand up. I don't know. It's what it weird. Yeah, I think that thoughts become things. I think that I'm very Jiminy Cricket about the life I've been given and the way this whole thing has evolved.
Thank you, Darren.
And I haven't really chased, you know, much of what's happening to me right now and all. The last 25 years, my concentration has been on my recovery and all, and it's kind of and wonderful things have happened. Tracy's a classic example. I mean, she heard me say that my choo-choo runs on gratitude and trust, and she came up with a whole idea for the book and a way to share on this message and all and everything. So the older I get, the less and less I feel like I have to do with the creation of the best things in my lives. It feels like it really is at this point all a gift. And it's not funny, but it's a really, really wonderful, comforting feeling to know that you can just get up in the morning and be led to what you're supposed to do that day if you listen, you know?
Well, the scene in the movie where you go to the Philippines, and I believe it's a shot of a busboy who knows the words to one of your songs.
What I call a heart payment, yeah.
Yeah, and we had Mike Nesmith on the show, who we know you know, and he was talking about why he
never liked
out.
Him.
What?
Yeah.
Interesting. No,
sorry, I had an attack of the Gilbert.
Interesting.
Say it in my voice.
Yeah, I never liked him.
I like that. I think you should be more Gilbert. I think we're going to have to do that.
Exactly.
Make you more Gilbert, yeah.
Oh, I love Mike. He was so talented, too.
He was just talking about gratitude, about how the faces of the Monkees fans, that even though there are parts of the Monkees that didn't mean that much to him or he didn't appreciate it while it was happening, he looks into the eyes of people that it was such an important part of their lives.
A huge part of their lives, yeah.
And it just... He does feel the same kind of
really,
gratitude.
Really good songwriter, too.
A wonderful songwriter.
Listen
drum.
To the Band was a big hit. I actually had a song that was supposed to be a big hit, and they on the B-side
Someday,
was
Listen
to the Band, and they turned it over and played his side, you know. But I forgive him because it was really... Because you got paid for the B-side, too, you know, so... But yeah, you know, his mother invented Whiteout.
We had a whole interview with him about it.
Liquid paper.
You know,
yeah, Mike's true. The two great no's in my life, two important no's in my life, is I auditioned for the Mouseketeers and the Monkees, and they both turned me down, which was a real gift. Oh Lord, was that a gift?
You'd have made a kick-ass monkey. I mean, a kick-ass Mouseketeer rather.
I'd have been a better Mouseketeer.
You'd have been a
monkey.
Great Mouseketeer.
Do you think the Monkees would have ruined you, your career?
We're talking about singing or sex. Over the edge.
I mean, would it?
No,
because
no.
I mean, they became so big.
Oh, would yeah. Well, you know what? It would have. In a way, it would have done what being an entertainer did for my craft. Because I think, as I said earlier, that you know that need to get all that attention pulled me away from songwriting. There's no way in the world that I could have become a songwriter and being one of the Monkees. That was a full time job, you know. So yeah, it would not have been good for me. It was great for Davey. They already had one little guy, and a little guy with a big talent. You know.
And Tracy, go ahead. Go ahead, Gil.
No, I was going to say in the film, in the biography, you see people come up to you who are crying at your concert, and it's funny. Like the first instinct I have is always like, oh God, are they pathetic? Look at them crying over some entertainer and blah, blah, blah. And then you get that feeling, you get the second thought of like, wow, he means this much to their lives.
Yeah.
And it's like a nice thing.
He has a real core group of like, oh, I shouldn't say this. I'm like Gilbert's. What
oh,
the
I love
fuck?
When you self-edit.
They're like,
I mean,
they're like,
toss
they're like,
it out the
no, they're like
it.
Middle age. They fall between say 50 and 60. They're usually really overweight, and they tend to be single. This is true, right? And they kind of follow you around. They just show up in an airport. You can always see them from a mile away. Is that true? It is kind of
they're
your core group.
They're always beautiful, and
I've just lost so many friends.
Oh my God! It's just, you know, the thing is, look, it's like it's. What's there's? I actually tweeted a great quote this morning that applies, and it was.
You can't read your tweets on things.
I know. I'm having a senior moment. I can't remember what it was, but it was perfect for that. It's not, and it's the Larry David Show. No, wait. Never mind. Let's. I'll be back.
They're
in a minute.
Not all overweight. I'm taking it back. I feel like guilty about the fat part.
I'm
going to
go look for my conscious mind. I'll be right back.
So some are thin.
Gilbert's rubbing off on you.
This is you off drugs.
But there was some brain damage, Gilbert. Yeah. You know, there was a few. A little bit of neurons aren't quite synced up.
No, but you know, the fact is that there is a bunch of Paul Williams fans that fall into the description that she speaks of, and I think I wrote a lot because I wrote a lot about loneliness and heartache and feeling like you didn't fit in. I think there's that kind of emotion underneath a lot of the songs. There's a lot of people in this world that feel that way, you know.
Well, yeah, because you wrote all of your songs seem to be like that, like, you know, someone being lonely.
Ouch, mommy just, songs.
Yeah.
Well, Rainy Days and Mondays was part inspired by your mom.
You know, my mom used to she would talk to herself. She would, you know, she would go, "God has a plan for you, my son." And then she'd walk off, and she'd find me write my little songs in the morning. I'd be sitting there. She'd go to work, you know, and she'd say, "Don't worry, my son, God has a plan." And then she walked off, you'd hear, "Son of a bitch, I hope so." She'd talk to herself, and I'd ask her about it, and she'd say, which for her was a word.
Yeah.
"I'm just feeling old." So Roger Nichols plays a beautiful melody for me, and I hear, "What am I going to write about?" And I remember my mom and talking to myself and feeling old. But that's a song where we wrote most of that song, and it took me probably a month to figure out what I was going to do to not just be down, because I didn't want the song to just be a downer. And then all of a sudden I went, "Wait a minute. Funny, but it seems I always wind up here with you. Nice to know somebody loves me." And I found a way to make it positive, which I think is kind of a feature in most of my songs, too, that they have a positive outcome.
Yeah.
And I'm listening. For I'm sure. going, "He does a terrible Paul Williams."
I was just saying, I'd like to hear Gilbert sing that. Yeah. What's your Gilbert doing?
"There's no getting over here. My smallest dreams won't come true." That's the way you remember me.
Yeah.
"I'm sorry, I don't sound that way anymore. You know, the sinus is cleared up.
Talking to myself and feeling old. Sometimes I'd like to quit. Nothing ever seems to fit. Hanging around. Some kind of lonely clone."
See, what I love is the fact that you know the words to these songs.
He
which
does.
Is really touching.
He's
to
a
me.
Fan.
Thank you.
Why
that's
do I feel like this
call,
is going to end up in his act
that's
pretty
what
soon?
I call
he's
a
like,
heart payment. You know, that's he knows the words to all these songs.
Even if he's making he's fun of you, it's okay. Any attention is good attention.
Inside Gilbert is an overweight 55-year-old single woman, and that's why he's a huge success. Yes.
He didn't pull these out for you, Paul.
With a lot of cats.
Yeah. I'll direct you to earlier episodes where he was doing, where we just got into Paul Williams songs and he just started singing.
Oh, I love that.
So
love
he didn't
it.
He
you.
Didn't just trot this out because you're here.
Wow.
He's actually obsessed.
Well, we're together again.
"Days are short and the nights grow colder. Some people get twice, but you just got older. And you never listened anyway. That's the hell of it."
Oh, my God. Man with the paradise.
"Good for nothing, bad in
told
bed.
You.
Some
nobody likes you and you're better off dead. Goodbye.
Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Goodbye. Oh, we all came to say goodbye."
Oh, my God. Oh, I love it. I love it.
I would have paid to be here today.
Me too. Me too.
Did We've Only Just Begun really begin as a bank jingle?
Had all the romantic beginnings of a bank commercial. It did. Roger Nichols and I were asked to write the song. We wrote the song for this pretty little commercial, and Richard Carpenter called and asked if there was a whole song. The number one album at the time was in a Gotta Da Vida. There's no way in the world that
Butterfly.
Song was going to be
right.
a hit song until an angel sang it. And when Karen sang it, people responded.
So Richard Carpenter saw the bank commercial?
The bank commercial recognized my voice. So I was singing the commercial. You know,
incredible.
"We've only just begun.
We've only just begun to live what lesson promises. A kiss for look and we're on."
Is it Paul Williams or is it Memorex? Is it Paul Williams or is it Gottlieb?
We've only just begun.
Biner, listen to yourself.
John Biner, we should get John Biner for the show.
Get John
and
the
Tracy,
show.
Speaking of writing, you were a Neil Simon fan. And how did you started out wanting to be an actress? How do you make the
Jewish Elvis?
Yes.
The Jewish Elvis.
How do you make the transition into writing?
Well, the truth is, there was this lesbian who was in love with me.
I like it already.
Right there.
We should devote the entire show to this story.
And no, it's a very true story. And she's dead, so I can tell the whole story. There was this lesbian who had a lot of money who was in love with me, and she was a producer in her spare time. And she also decided that she wanted to be straight. So she fell in love with Derek Jacobi, who's like the gayest person in England.
Oh,
and she
Jacobi.
Was going to... And she was producing shows for him. So at one point she said to me, because I was funny and I wasn't getting any acting work and she wanted to sleep with me, she said, you should write. And if you write a play, I'll produce it on Broadway. Well, I was 27 years old. I thought, I can, you know, sit down and do this. So I thought, yeah, I want a Broadway show. I'm not going to sleep with her, but I want the Broadway show. So I kind of, anyway. So I sat down and in 3 weeks I wrote a play. And somewhere in the middle of the play, I just realized, this is what I should do. And then she got mad at me at lunch a couple weeks later and just sort of walked out of my life. But I had a play. And you know, it someone saw it at ICM and they took me on. And within a year, I was sitting under a palm tree in Hollywood with a deal with Bud Grant at, you know, who just left CBS. And I had my own show on the air within a year and a half after that. So it was really fast. It just sort of happened. But Dave, if this girl, it's how do things happen? That literally was the way it happened. I think if she hadn't said do it, I don't know what I would have done. I would probably be working at a Red Lobster right now.
Well, you're both people who started pursuing acting.
Yeah. Yeah,
Paul, too. Paul, you wanted to be Montgomery Clift.
And both started writing at like 27, which is really
interesting. Well, I think there's this age. I was having dinner with a friend the other night, and their son was starting to give up acting, and he's 30. I went, well, you know, you get to this age, and you go, okay, maybe it's time that I'm a grown-up. Yeah, I mean, if I haven't made – I'd actually been in a film called Heartburn that Mike Nichols put me in, and – I went and I shot the scene with Meryl Streep, and then the next day I was standing in line at Equity waiting for some, you know, roadshow production of a Beth Henley play or something. And I realized I can't live like this. Yeah, you know, this is a terrible life. So, you know, writing, that was it. And I've been writing ever since.
Why didn't you sleep with her?
She just wasn't my type. She was really bossy, and good I'm answer. The only bossy one in the room.
Well, make
part
something
of me
up
right there. You know, part of me went, wait a minute. Why didn't you?
Could you make
I
something?
I also didn't know that we both started writing.
I've only,
at
I've never told that story before,
You've
actually, because she's dead. Like, well, she's
now,
dead. I can say it.
Isn't 27 the age, the magic age when people die?
Rock stars die. Yeah.
Yeah. Janis Joplin and.
Yeah, there must be more.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
27.
I'll Google
the
it.
Magic
you
age.
Die or a lesbian falls in love with you.
What's his name with the guitar?
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix. Who?
A bunch of famous rock stars all died at 27.
Jim Morrison.
Jim Morrison.
Our research team is on
exactly.
it. Thank you, Dara.
How old was James Dean?
How old was Kurt Cobain, too?
James Dean, maybe. Maybe younger. Yeah, I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah.
27 Club.
Now Jesus made it to 33, didn't he? So that's pretty old.
That's the rumor.
But he wasn't singing.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank God he
had he been
up
in a band.
James Dean was 24.
24.
Thank you, Dara. Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
That, was, that whole fast car thing.
Fast
you go sooner. Yeah.
Yeah.
And was not interviewed on the Joe Franklin Show with Al Pacino.
Oh, yes. Joe Franklin came on. And, you know, Joe Franklin talks about himself quite a bit in his day when he was. And he would have these stories saying that, oh, on one of my shows, I had on both James Dean and Al Pacino. And we did the math, and Al Pacino would have been 10 at the time.
God love you, Joe.
Joe, well, he just didn't, you know. Well, those cards get, you know, get moved around in the later years. I'm observing some of that myself already.
So speaking of acting, Paul, you wanted to be Monty Clift.
And I always joke that I felt like Montgomery Clift, and I looked like Haley Mills. That was the And it was really, really hard to get.
So you could have done Parent Trap.
I could have done
true.
Parent Trap.
It would have been great.
I could have, exactly.
And you wanted to be a movie star, really.
Yeah, I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be a movie star. I loved Montgomery Clift. My two favorite actors in the world had totally different styles. They were Spencer Tracy and Montgomery Clift. And I just, watching them, that's what I wanted. I didn't want to be me. More than wanting to be an actor, I didn't want to be Paul Williams. And that's the, you know, that's the little time on the couch took me finally to that point of view. So, once again, a fascinating story about my childhood. That,
no, you know, I think Peter Sellers said something very similar in an interview, that he wanted to be somebody else. He was always better at being someone else.
Sure, sure. Yeah, playing ourselves is weird. You know, it's, I mean, it's... If you're on a set, it takes me like 2 days to lose what I call losing my hands. You know, if I get an acting job, because there's a lot of space in between the acting jobs, there's about 2 days where I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to sit. I don't know how to walk. You know, it's called, and I call it losing my hands. And you know what I'm talking about?
Oh yes.
Just like, okay, yeah. This is really simple. This is just an establishing shot. We want you to get out of the car, walk over, walk in, and walk up to the counter where you'll have a conversation. We'll pick it up there. Okay, walk from the car to the counter.
you turn into Jerry Lewis.
You turn into the, yeah. I don't know how to do this, you know. But yeah, I think, you know, that I looking back, I didn't know how to be me. And I certainly didn't feel much of anything in those days. Before I drank alcoholically, I acted alcoholically. And the way an alcoholic acts is he just doesn't feel stuff. He avoids it. You know? He avoids it, which I did.
I don't think people who know you as a songwriter are aware of the fact that you were also a child actor. That
was,
you were.
Well, I was in my 20s when I was playing children. You know,
that's, right, but that's what. Well, that's what
yeah,
I meant.
I played a 13-year-old when I was in my early 20s, and the loved one. I played the boy genius.
The loved one, right?
I mean, you weren't Gary Coleman or anything.
No, I wasn't Gary Coleman.
Gilbert and I loved the loved one.
Jonathan Winters in it.
Yeah,
and
Sir
Rod
John Gielgud.
Yeah, Rod Steiger. James Coburn had a small part. It was just an amazing cast and all. Sir John Gielgud
right.
and all. Huge.
And here you're a kid from the Midwest walking onto a movie set.
I walk onto that set and you see that big old Panavision camera and Haskell Wexler and all these people. And it's like, oh, my God.
And Frank and I were talking before that you're in a movie with Robert Duvall.
That's The Chase, with Marlon Brando, Jane Fonda, Robert Duvall.
Arthur Penn.
Little Arthur Penn. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I actually, on the set, was playing with a guitar. I shared a dressing room with a guy that had a nice guitar, and so I picked up his guitar. I said, don't mess with that. That's a Martin. I said, oh, okay. You know, I went and got a little guitar, painted it so it would look good. It was brilliant. And I started just doodling. I actually doodled a little song in that movie that Robert Duvall said, come here and show it to the director, and Arthur Penn filmed it and put it in the movie before I was a songwriter. It was just doodling. It's doodling.
You never know what's going to happen.
You never know. The Big Amigo led me to it.
You'd credit that with kicking off a musical career?
Well, you know, it's a billboard. It's like one of those, you know, one of those moments where you kind of, you look back at your life and before you, when you know, before, you know, from the other, looking from the other end, young to old, you'd never see it. And I certainly didn't. But looking back, you go, oh my God, there's a billboard there. There's, you scratch out two lines of a silly little song and they stick it in a movie. Wait a minute. Maybe you should examine the idea of being a songwriter. It took another couple of years to get to that. And that brought the room to an absolute.
Yes.
Suddenly, you know. And ladies and gentlemen, that's what we like to call room tone.
I think we need Gilbert to sing a little bit of Someday Man now.
Oh, wait.
He doesn't know that one.
Okay.
Tracy, you said you were a Paul Williams fan. So, what were you a fan of years before you met Paul? Was it the movies? Was it the songs?
It was the songs.
Was there something about him?
Well, I was a fat girl. I mean, and I was sitting in my room, and I had a screwed up childhood. And you know, Paul sang to that part in people. Loneliness. Gilbert, can you sing a couple rounds of Loneliness? Loneliness? You know,
how
Loneliness?
Does Loneliness? Wait.
I can't sing. Or I would, but you know, his songs really did speak to that part of you that was sad.
Yeah.
You know, and I think sad people related to Paul. And so I was sad. And I remember seeing him on probably Mike Douglas, probably Merv Griffin, because I couldn't stay up that late in those days to see you on Carson. And I just remember thinking, this guy's really fucking funny. I probably didn't say fuck then. I might have been 8 years old, but I thought it. And I
she
just
didn't say fuck till she was maybe
like nine. Yes, I have not stopped. But I remember thinking he's just hysterically funny, and I would stay up late to watch him on Carson.
Yeah,
and sometimes
me too.
And sneak it, you know. And I don't know what it was about. I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm kind of a believer in like things are sometimes meant to be. Anyway, so there was always, and I used to see him. I went to see him at the Universal Amphitheater, and I slugged my grandmother in the middle of the concert, and
which is on tape.
Which is on tape. She left me there.
Set recorder trying to record me, and gets in an argument with her grandmother,
and I slug her. I give me my ball, please. Should I slug my grandmother? Sent me home the next day.
Grandmother abuse. Elder abuse.
Elder abuse. song. At the age of 13, listening to Paul and Helen Reddy. But yeah, I just had always related. I liked Barry Manilow too, so I.
And Neil Diamond, you confess to.
Neil Diamond.
Yeah. See, like Barry Manilow also seems to get like a cult following.
He does.
Of people follow him from city to city.
Because they're songs for the lonely hearts, kind of like yeah. some of Paul's compositions.
Yeah, so I just, that was it. You know, that was my, and then it kind of went away. And I always liked the music. I've always liked Paul's music. Yeah. Now there's Paul.
Yeah.
And you know, you're an underrated comedian. I mean, you're known for being a songwriter and a singer, but you've got a, if you allow me to say, you've got a knack for comedy.
Well, life is funny. You know,
at least one of us has a knack for.
Yeah, I would never say that about him.
life is funny.
Is there an ear for humor, sort of like an ear for music? Do you have to be able to hear it? Do you have to be able to hear the rhythm of a joke?
I have no idea. I just think life is funny, and I love funny, and I love sharp funny. You talk about Carlin, you talk about reading Judd's book, Judd Apatow's book. I mean, he talks about he wrote a Gilligan's Island joke when he was like 10 or something. And I read it and I went, oh my God. I mean, the joke was, if they were only going on a 3-day trip, why do they have all that luggage?
Right. You know?
3 hours. It was a three-hour tour.
Right.
Well, I heard that Mel Brooks, when he was auditioning for his films, he wanted the actors to sing. He wanted to hear if they were musical.
Because of the rhythm.
Yeah, I think there's a connection. The Marx Brothers, old musical. I always thought, Who's On First had a real catchy musical sound to it.
But
you hear it or you don't. Don't you think, Gilbert, you can't teach people to be funny. I remember when I used to teach screenwriting for years. You can teach people technique. But either you hear funny in your head like music or you don't. That's the way it's always been for me. Either you hear, and if someone goes off one beat, if they're reading something you've written, it's like you play a musical instrument and you're off one chord. It screws the whole thing up, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that true with a joke? I mean, one beat and the whole thing falls flat.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be a nanosecond and it falls flat.
Well, that's why I always love to talk about the Abbott and Costello TV movie where Buddy Hackett and
Harvey Korman.
Harvey Korman were doing Abbott and Costello, and the bits were like completely off.
They weren't funny.
Yeah, and the whole thing that makes it so addictive. Sorry, but what makes it addictive? Yeah, is with like a Who's On First or anything like that, where it's so musical.
Yeah, the rhythm. Rhythm and the timing.
Yeah.
But like watching a comedy piece, and I did a lot of research, and watching you go on The Tonight Show in your Planet of the Apes costume and your makeup, and you sing, if I'm correct, Here Comes That Rainy Day.
Yeah.
The timing, the way you're waiting, the way you're taking pauses. I mean, I'm watching a comedian. I don't think I'm watching a musician.
I'll tell you what I'm proud of about that appearance is I had a line that I still think is funny, and it still gets a big laugh. Is Carson asked me when he touches my orangutan face, he says, this is for a movie. And I said, no, this is 6 months of nothing but banana daiquiris.
Now here's something.
It's a great line. Send the doc.
You've acted with and been friends with Pat McCormick.
Oh.
Can you tell us a famous story that had to do with a helicopter?
Pat McCormick. The helicopter with Pat McCormick? Are you thinking about Sid Caesar with the helicopter?
Oh, I heard it with Pat McCormick.
There's Sid Caesar version?
It's the aerial phone.
Even Tracy knows the story.
I know every story, Frank.
Go ahead, you do it.
Okay. I'm going to do the story for you?
You do it.
Yeah, come on, Tracy. Right. See if it works for you doing it.
All right, let's see if I can do it. All right, so you and Pat McCormick, you meet and you go to a bar and you spend the entire night in a bar and you're shit-faced drunk, the two of you. Okay. And you stumble out of the bar and it's in Burbank and it's sort of at daylight and you can't see and Pat McCormick looks down at you and he says, you look like an aerial photograph of a human being.
Yeah.
That's not the story. That's a good one, but that's not the story.
You look like an aerial photograph of a human being, and then he says to me,
"Well, I wasn't there. I didn't know his inflections."
Which made me love him, of course. He offers a lot of shade. I also like that. But he said, you know what, little guy? I don't remember where I parked my car. You're going to have to help me find where I parked my car. I said, okay. What kind of a car is it? And he went, oh, no, that would be cheating. Pat and I in a helicopter.
I
can't imitate a drunk because I never drank.
This is the story
I heard.
If it's true.
This will be funny.
And well, actually, I think it may be true because I met Tim Conway. And I was once working with him, and I said, I know a story about Pat McCoy. And without even completing the name, he goes, helicopter? And I heard that he and a bunch of his pals would get together once a year and try to outdo each other with, like, the dinners they throw for each other.
Yeah.
And each one would have a more elaborate, expensive, fancier dinner. And then one time they got everyone in a van, McCormick, and he had them, took them out to a heliport. And each one by one, was given a bag with a tuna sandwich and an apple. And they said, you know, what the hell's this? And they were put on a helicopter with a hooker. And the helicopter was instructed to circle their house as the hooker was blowing them.
Wow, I wish I'd known him then.
You were not invited on that journey.
I think that might have been before we were pals, you know. Or, you know what? That son of a bitch held out on me. I knew there was something there. Oh, my God. Sweets, why would you not do that with me? You know,
you were a great team.
Tuna sandwich and a blowjob, and you missed out.
Yeah, exactly.
Boy, right. Paulie.
He was big Enos to your little Enos.
Smokey and the Bandit 1, 2, and even worse, yeah. And I got to tell you, I mean, to this day, you get off a plane in Nashville or in Dallas, and or you go into a senator's office, you know, on the Hill, and little Enos Burdett. God, I love those movies. We had no idea. They
oh
still
my God,
live.
Walking through an airport with him in the South.
Yeah,
it is not
that.
Fun.
Yeah.
And getting back to Robert Blake, because I remember he eventually, I think he caught on that he then hated Carson for bringing him on because Robert Blake always had, like, kind of emotional problems.
D's, Dems, and Do's.
Yeah, and he felt like Carson was just using him as, like, this nutty guy.
Yeah, I didn't have a real relationship with Blake. I saw him a few times through the years. We were always friendly and all. There was a certain point where he, I ran into him one time I just realized it's a story I can't tell because it's involved something else. But, you know, in other words, this is a story without an ending. Take it, Tracy.
Didn't he kill? Okay. Didn't Robert Blake kill somebody? Didn't he kill somebody?
Allegedly.
He allegedly killed. Who did he allegedly?
His wife. Bonnie somebody. Bonnie.
Yeah. And he's dead.
Yeah. No, Robert's
no,
with
Robert
us.
Blake's yeah. alive,
but he's
right?
not in jail. I'm no, really confused about the whole thing.
He was acquitted.
Robert.
Well, it's L.A. Yeah. So he was acquitted. And
it was kind of he sort of pulled a Phil Spector or not? I don't know, but not quite.
Well, Phil,
we don't know,
you know,
but he's in jail.
And you can't get in the Frank Bar to Hotel. Say it either. It's like
we don't know.
Back away from that story.
And
yeah.
Frank, was all okay.
Yeah.
But I was right that there was like a little thing about like someone died.
What was his wife?
Yeah, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, yeah, but he was acquitted, so he's still on our guest list.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I think you should interview him.
Oh, I would love to. Yeah.
Does he do interviews?
No.
I don't
Let's
think
talk
so.
About something safer. Okay. How about Claudine Langer?
Go ahead.
What the?
Oh, Spider Savage.
Oh, because she killed. Oh, yes,
she killed.
By accident.
By accident.
Yes. Celebrity deaths for 100.
She got off the hook too, Paul.
And so did William Shatner.
I'll take Tracy Jackson to block.
Oh, well, the Shatner thing.
Oh, you think
the swimming
Shatner
the swimming pool
his wife?
Thing?
What was the thing in the swimming pool?
She drowned in the swimming pool.
Oh, she just drowned.
Yeah.
So she just needed swimming lessons.
Yeah, but if he withheld the swim lessons,
the show has taken an ugly turn.
It's turned into Hollywood Babble.
Wow.
Who was the guy? No, Frank will know this.
Yeah.
Who was the guy from SNL and his wife? He did kill his wife.
Tony Rosato.
No, someone else. No, the comedian. Actor, the comedian.
But he never actually
killed the comedian.
Was killed
by it. No,
he thought comedian was killed by his wife, Phil.
Oh, well, he's in jail.
And he killed.
He was in jail.
Oh, he's out now.
Now we're talking about
put him on the guest list.
He's in jail. No, he's out.
Who's in jail? Who was in jail?
Who are you referring to, Tracy?
Tony Rosato.
Tony Rosato was a comic from Second City who became an SNL guy.
He was on SNL. He was totally.
Phil, you're talking about Phil, who was killed by his wife.
Oh, Phil Hartman.
Oh no, the wife. Yeah, the wife.
The other way around. Yeah,
and then shot him.
Come on, Trace.
It's hard to keep all these things straight.
Yeah, he was sleeping and she shot him and then shot herself.
Yeah.
All right.
That valley. That San Fernando Valley will do bad things to your head. Yeah. I'm telling you. Stay out of Encino.
Once you get north of Moore Park.
All bad
shit happens.
Encino and you just lose it. You start killing people. It's like a post office, like a big post office out there.
We're winding down, but I'm going to ask Paul about Ishtar. Which I love. Now, please don't tell me that you're disowning it because it was part of your lost decade.
Oh, no, I'm so proud of it. I'm so, I think I worked 18 months on it, you know. I think I spent the first year of it trying to get Warren to tell me I had the job, you know. Warren Beatty was like, we just, you know, it was write something write these songs, these intentionally bad songs, to be sung by Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman with a screenplay, a really hilarious screenplay. By Elaine May. Elaine was going to direct, and it was an amazing opportunity to work on something that was. And I kept writing songs. I couldn't get Elaine to tell me what she wanted, you know. She said, "I'll know when I see it." She did that with the actors. She'd do take after take after take. What do you want? I'll know when I see it. And I would write stuff and write stuff and write stuff, and by then I was on salary. It was it was great. Columbia was pumping money into my bank account, and I finally wrote a song. I wrote. A song called "The Lawnmower Can Do All That."
That's great.
Saturday morning, the sound of a lawnmower touches my soul, brings back the memory of first summer love of Ella and me. That a lawnmower can do all that. That a lawnmower can do all that. That a lawnmower can do all that. It's amazing. Got to sing the bridge. I can see you're standing in the backyard of my mind. She cracks her knuckles, and the scab that's on her knee won't go away. I can see the woman waiting in her eyes, and I can see the love, but I can't see the Brooklyn Dodgers in L.A. That a lawnmower can
great.
Do all that. And Elaine May went, that's what I'm looking for. And I was off and running. It was a great job.
Was not hard to write a bad song, intentionally write a bad song?
Oh, no. Au contraire. I would say that to write a believably bad song, to write a song that starts out great that you then screw up. Telling the truth can be dangerous business. Honest and popular don't go hand in hand.
That's great.
Pretty good up till there. If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band. It's like, wait a minute, where did they go? You know?
I saw the film recently. Elaine May came out at the 92nd Street Y and showed the film, and it's unfairly maligned. I mean, the press attacked it because she ran over budget and because she ran over schedule, but it's funny. And Drack Weston's great. Charles Grodin's great.
It's so funny.
I urge our listeners to look at Ishtar.
Tracy and I went out to where was it? They had the
Astoria, the Film Academy in Astoria.
Yeah, the
Film Museum.
Film Museum, exactly, and Moving Images, or whatever. And I hadn't seen Elaine since we did it, but we were able to spend a little bit of time with her. It was great and all. And of course, the other side of it is that Tracy was friends with Mike Nichols and all. And you actually introduced me to Mike when he was interviewed by Judd Apatow. So.
That's true, but I don't have any Mike.
You don't have any Mike Nichols stories?
Not that are funny. Oh, no. Yeah.
Well, you're a screenwriter. I mean, what did you think of Ishtar? I mean, is it not entirely successful, but there are some really great things in it.
Songs are good.
And the songs are damn good.
What was that guy who should? I think Ishtar is funny. There's no question. I mean, it's no Saturday Night Fever, but no, it's a very it's a funny film. It is a funny film.
An attempt to make a Hope and Crosby picture.
Yeah. It was. I mean, I prefer Phantom of the Paradise, but I know. Yeah, I think it probably is maligned, and who knows why it's maligned? Maybe.
But it's
coming back. You know, people now really do include it in pictures that are good that people always trash.
I think it's going to be
getting now that kind of rep. I think
it got a good.
I read something the other day like pictures that are trashed that are really good. Ishtar.
New York Times finally gave it a good review. 40 years later, whatever.
Yeah, Blu-ray. Blu-ray has a way of changing people's minds.
Well, I mean, even Duck Soup was not well received. I mean, there are movies that gain a reputation over the years, and I really do believe Ishtar is going to be one. So,
We do a mini episode on Thursdays where we recommend movies. Oh, nice. And I'm jumping the gun and recommending Ishtar and Paul and the songs of Paul Williams.
Oh, lovely.
Sung by Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes. Yeah.
Sung by Gilbert Gottfried.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side?
Keep singing.
See, had when you insulted me, I'd known Gilbert is such a good rendition of you. I would have liked him instead of Neil Diamond. Think of it that way.
You know, yeah. I about maybe three or four times on stage did a bit when I didn't care if the audience was following me or not. I used to do a bit of, this is true, years ago I used to do this, Paul Williams fucking Shirley Temple.
Tracy is clutching her chest.
At what age?
Well, I don't want to say that or it would just be wrong. Okay, here's Paul Williams fucking Shirley Temple.
Oh, Shirley, your pussy is so tight. Oh, Miss, Mr. Williams, I really like your big, veiny, hairy dick. Oh, Shirley, would you like to give me a blowjob, Shirley? Oh, yes. Oh, your dick in my mouth. It feels so good. Oh, I'm going to come.
Oh my God.
I'm going to come, Shirley. Oh, it's good for me. Oh, Mr. Williams. Oh, can I fuck you in the ass? Oh, yes, Mr. Williams. I would be honored.
Oh, Lord.
I may have just had a peak experience in my life.
Can I take my dick out of your ass and smack you across the head with it? Oh, yes, I would be honored.
Here's the line.
Oh, my wow. God.
Here's Gil.
You finally found the line.
Oh, my God.
Well,
they would have been the same size.
Tracy's losing
it. Good ship lollipop.
Oh, you curly blonde cunt. I want to go down on it.
It could have been a new lollipop on the good ship lollipop.
Oh, wow. You notice I have stayed out of this totally. You know,
he's turned several colors.
Every now and then there's a little wisdom in the wound, as Oprah says. There's a little wisdom in the wound that I back away, you know. And I didn't say any of the things that occurred to me.
See, if you were still drinking, you would have really been fun in that moment.
Off the air, I will share a couple lines with you that occurred to me that...
Can't wait. We'll bring them to lunch.
Oh my
now, these people want to eat, so we should wrap the show up. But
God,
you're both movie buffs, big-time movie buffs. And I saw a Turner Classic Movies podcast interview with you when you were talking about Lonely or the Brave, and you were talking about Sergeant York. Yeah. So for the two... The actor and the screenwriter, we're just going to throw out some random questions. Favorite character actor, any era? Tracy?
Oh, God. John Cleese. I'm sorry.
John Cleese.
I just think John. Fish Called Wanda is my favorite movie ever. I don't know why. But John Cleese, to me, is hysterically funny. No matter what he does, I laugh. I know maybe he's not considered, like, the total.
We'll take it. Not, I wouldn't have thought of him as a character actor.
You wouldn't?
No.
Really?
I would think of him as a leading man in comedies, but yeah, it's if you stretch it. I was going more for the sort of Walter Brennan...
Arthur Honeycutt.
George Kennedy, Arthur Honeycutt.
Go for it.
But I'll take it.
I have to... My favorite... Oh, like George Kennedy, like Burgess Meredith, like those guys?
Yeah, well, Gilbert loves Burgess Meredith.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, then for Gilbert, I'll say Burgess Meredith.
Okay.
Because I love the original of Mice and Men.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. I'm a big Lon Chaney Jr. fan, of course.
Rocky, he was pretty... I mean, he's... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'll someone go. Like that. Paul?
Eli Wallach.
Great.
Oh, great one.
Good choice.
Yeah. Misfits.
Yeah, wow. Sure.
Yeah.
Baby Doll.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also, I mean, there's guys like Royal Dano. I mean,
love Royal Dano.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, yeah. That, yeah. But yeah, Eli Wallach, I mean, he was just a great actor. Just a great actor. And Misfits is one of my favorite movies ever, you know.
This one's for you, Tracy. Best or smartest romantic comedy that people don't talk about or give enough credit to? I know you wrote some rom-coms.
Oh, that people don't give enough credit to?
Underrated. An underrated romantic comedy.
I'm putting you on the spot.
You're really putting me on the spot because... Oh, shoot. Ask Paulie another question. Let me think.
No, no, you do.
I got to go off the top. I don't have an underrated. When Harry
How about
met
favorite?
My favorite, When Harry Met Sally.
Okay.
I mean, I kind of like films from the 90s on. I know you guys all love the old films. I'm really one of those sort of like 90s on people.
Fair enough.
Can I put you totally on the spot?
Yeah.
Most overrated film.
Oh, the most overrated film.
We'll
probably
letters.
Notting Hill.
Notting Hill. Okay.
I think.
Good cast. I missed that one.
What? I mean, that's just maybe. Maybe. Oh, God. I'm really bad about that. I mean, maybe if you go back to the 80s. I mean, Coming Home doesn't count, does it? It wasn't funny.
No, but I
but I really but loved
I,
it.
I love Hal Ashby.
I really I love Hal Ashby shampoo. I love
Paralyzed from the waist.
Yeah,
it's very funny.
Oh my God! But then when he goes down on it, I'm sorry. That's like one of the great scenes. I'd never seen anybody go down on anyone until that movie. That stuck in my head. I'm sorry. It meant a lot to me.
The next day, our hair was curly
all across the boards.
Right. Okay.
Really.
Shout out to Hal Ashby.
I'm sorry, I'm too horny to actually answer any more questions now. You know, now she keeps doing that.
Best TV theme song that you didn't write.
Oh, the best TV theme song that I didn't write. Wow.
Because to the man who wrote
Fox
The Love
wrote
Boat.
Great ones. Charlie Fox wrote Happy Days. He wrote Laverne and Shirley.
You write Love American Style?
Love American
Style. I love
Style.
That just, one.
You know, Charlie Fox was the best. He and I wrote Love Boat theme together and all, which was, but he wrote so many good ones and all. The theme for MASH is just, I mean, no words in it, but just a
written by Robert Altman's son, if I'm not mistaken.
Johnny Mandel.
Oh, Johnny Mandel. Didn't Robert Altman's son write the lyrics? Suicide is painless.
Suicide is painless. Yeah, but the music.
Johnny Mandel.
It's just great. Favorite sexual position with Shirley Temple. Well. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter which position we're in, as long as it says the name Black is on her dressing room door.
Oh, you don't.
But then to go back,
to
I would make
safe.
Her shave. You know, so I could pretend she was. No, wait a minute. See, that's what I wasn't going
to
say, and then I went.
Place.
You know, I know
that's
you
a
do.
Healthy place to go to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gil, for corrupting my childhood hero. Appreciate that. All right, last movie one. For Tracy, movie that changed you or rocked your world?
Well, I guess we have to go back to Coming Home.
Really? Coming
no.
Home.
Changed me or
changed
rocked my
thinking.
World? Changed my thinking about
you know,
everything ever?
Knocked you for a loop.
I'm really bad. You know, now I'm on the spot. The movie that rocked my world was The Way We Were.
Okay.
But again, it's a sex scene. It's when Robert Redford has sex with Barbara Streisand, and it's like, yes, handsome men will have sex with ugly girls.
I think we got a recurring theme here.
I those were the films. Yeah, those two. Those did it.
Okay. Good choices. Paul, life-changing movie?
I'm younger
Atticus
than he is. That's
Finch.
Why, you know.
Oh, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Atticus Finch.
Great.
Daddy we all wanted to have.
I love it.
The most amazing film, my favorite film maybe in the whole world.
Robert Mulligan.
Exactly.
Why are mine all sex and yours are all like parents?
Yeah. Yeah. But except the thing that's great is that in my real life, I'm all about sex and no, wait a minute. No, that's not a show either. I think that movie just on some. There are a couple movies that drove me to music. One of them is Man with a Golden Arm, which
oh,
is
sure.
because the music is part of the environment. And the other one would be Blackboard Jungle. Because it's 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock, and 5. It was the music was integral to the story. It was part of the environment, not just the score. And I think there was something that sucked me into film and music in those two pictures. But good movies, you know.
All good calls. Movies. Good choices.
I can't wait to watch Coming Home again.
You don't remember Coming Home?
I don't. Well, what year did it come out?
78.
Okay, by then I was. I was.
Go watch it.
That
to me was like a politically correct film, in that it's like the ideal man is a man who's paralyzed from the waist down. That's what that film was telling you.
And maybe I was onto something.
Yeah.
You know.
My former boss Joy Behar has a funny bit about Coming Home, where after the sex scene, her hair is curly. It was straight before the, and she comes out now she's got a fro.
The sex
was that good.
Yeah, it was a very it was definitely a mind blowing film. Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
I'm out of cards. Anything you want to ask these nice people, Gilbert?
Well, I think we could wind it up with you as Gilbert Gottfried and me as Paul Williams.
Should we lead Paul over there, or is that putting him on the spot?
I am a horrible piano player, so I would rather stay a cappella. But you know, I've been meaning to tell you that. What did it cost you to rent that thing?
Nothing. All right, they just threw it in case you wanted to play. I didn't know your instrument of choice.
No. Dream away, child. Dream your dreams, run wild. Her favorite song of mine is a song called Dream Away. But
are you doing it as Gilbert?
I'm doing it as Gilbert.
You won't be able to talk tomorrow on your podcast.
So.
My favorite Paul Williams.
An old-fashioned love song. Oh, here we go. Playing on the radio.
And wrapped around the music is the sound of someone promising they'll never go. Take it, Polly.
You swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on and on.
No need in bringing them back. They never really, you know, it's the gone, whatever.
Just an old song.
What fashion. You left out fashion.
Oh, what?
I mean, fashion. You left out. Oh, my God. Which one am I? We'll be back with one of us someday.
Wait. What's the next?
Before we go, you got to plug the book. Tell us the book. Tell us the podcast.
Look, Gratitude and Trust, 6 Affirmations That Will Change Your Life, written by Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson.
And the podcast, Gratitude and Trust.
Starting in June with their first guest, Judd Apatow.
Our first guest will be Chris Hardwick. Our first guest will be Chris Hardwick. And then,
but we're taping Judd Apatow first. And then, you know, the world of podcasts, right, guys?
We tape Judd tomorrow. We tape
David Steinberg, Penn Jillette.
Wow, you're stealing all our guests.
I know we are. I looked at your roster and I went, grab it.
Damn it.
Okay, here, so you won't have to listen to it. Here's Paul Williams interviewing David Steinberg.
So, David, tell us how you first started doing comedy.
Well, I started doing comedy when I was in Canada.
Oh, well,
Winnipeg.
Yes. Well, Winnipeg sounds like a lovely place.
Oh, yes. Yes, I enjoyed living in Winnipeg very much.
I love Winnipeg. What a treat. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Could you please tell
me... He won't stop the show, Paul.
Could you please tell me what it was like... Fucking Shirley Temple.
It's time for his medication. You know what?
I knew he was going.
Okay, we have one more time.
David.
Time for your medication, Gilbert. Time for your medication.
Well, David, it was... I like doing a 69 on Shirley.
We
got to This, I'm Gilbert Gottfried. This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre.
My new favorite episode. Thank you, guys.
At the Friars Club in New York City, where we've been interviewing Tracy Jackson and Paul Williams, who revealed today he fucked Shirley Temple. Yes.
As Pat McCormick watches from a helicopter.
And now let's go down to the kitchen and get shit-faced.
Thank you, guys. Wonderful show.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny and I love you.
A few days ago, Brooke Tudine posted an inspirational quote on her wall that got 17 likes and 3 comments. Thumbs up, Brooke. Geico also wants to make a comment. In just 15 minutes, you could save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance by switching to Geico. And nothing says inspiration better than saving money. Well, except for those posters that say things like teamwork, excellence, and make it happen. Hashtag keep climbing. Hashtag savings.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.